just hanging around. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Oh Lonesome Me by Don Gibson. Don Gibson was born on this day in 1928. On our way to our next conversation, I want to remind you all the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Money comes back in the end, and it belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union banner is there with all the information. This next segment of the Mark Steiner Show was inspired by someone who's almost here in the studio. It's been a tough day for weather. Michael Twitty, who is a culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and a blogger at Afroculinaria. He's also a Hebrew teacher. He's also African-American and Jewish and had an experience when he went to Israel to be part of a Jewish film festival and stopped at the airport by Israeli security. And when he was stopped at the airport by Israeli security, they would, A, not believe he was Jewish, and questioned him. It was basically a bevy of officers kind of degrading him and questioning who he was and separating him from his partner and more. And even though he spoke Hebrew to them and tried to give them all the knowledge he had, they wouldn't believe who he was. So there have been a lot of experiences about race in Israel and what it means to be black and Jewish in our society. There's stories I'll tell from my own family during the course of this conversation this hour, and invite you all to join us here at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner and log on to our Facebook page. It's 410-319-8888. And Michael will be here. Mike Tudy will be here in a minute. We are joined now by Yitz Jordan, or known as Y-Love, who is an Orthodox Jewish hip-hop artist originally from Baltimore. And Y-Love, welcome. Good to have you in the studio. Or good to have you with us here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. And Manish Tana is with us, author, blogger, and public speaker on the intersections of race and religion in American Judaism. And Manish Tana, good to have you with us as well.
Good to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and questions here for our guests. So let me start with you, Manish Tana. You saw what happened to Mike Twitty and Michael Twitty, and we'll talk to him about more directly when he gets in the studio. But tell me your visceral intellectual reactions to what occurred.
Somewhere between a combination of anger, outrage, and more of a, that's how things go. So I guess it's sort of, resignation, which is sad in and of itself, that this is just expected to happen.
And Y-Love, I mean, I'm curious, you know Mike Twitty as well, Michael Twitty as well. And,
yes.
Yeah, very well. And your first reactions to this when you saw that story?
I can't help but agree with Manish Tana, although I would say that there was more of that resignation and more of an expectation that that would be the quote unquote the way things go. I've heard horror stories from people, and not only black Jews, Asian Jews, just Jews of color in general, getting similar treatment at Ben Gurion Airport. So unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me.
So, when we talk about this, and Mike Twitty and I have talked about this a bunch, about this kind of strange intersection between blacks and Jews in our society, but especially when you are black and Jewish, and what that means in this culture and in that, and the complex place it puts you in, Manish Tana, I mean, in many ways, because it's almost if in many ways America treats people of African descent as the other, which is a huge problem in our culture. It's a double other, sometimes a triple other, depending on who you are. Manish, I'm just curious, just to speak to that.
Well, this is very definitely true. I like to joke with the Y-Love sometimes that being black and Jewish is like being black, it's more black added on. But a lot of the problem I see is the perception of, like, when people frame, black-Jewish relations, there's some invisible parentheticals that go along with that. What they really mean is, parenthesis,
non-Jewish blacks, because blacks, as we all know, are monolithically not Jewish, and parentheses, white Jews, because as we all know, Jews are monolithically white. And so when the conversation gets approached from this framing, it automatically is crippled.
And I, you know, and when and what happens to what happened a while ago to Mike Twitty in Israel is not an uncommon occurrence, as you all were talking about a moment ago. There is something. Go ahead, Wylov.
To add on to what Manish Sinha had said before, you know, there's that when there's that idea of a monolithic white Jewish community and a monolithic white Jewish identity, then you start to find many Jews buying into the concept of whiteness, and that unfortunately means buying into the concept of black people being other and not being able to look at the black person next to them and say, oh, that's my fellow Jew. I should be reaching out to them. I should be helping them. I should be treating them as I would treat one of my own. Instead, I'm dealing with someone from the other group. My last trip to Israel, on my way out, I had to deal with 6 security checkpoints in total, 5 which were actually necessary, one of which was because the soldier happened to be a Y Love fan and was into hip-hop and wanted to pull me over to the side so I could freestyle for him privately. But the other 5 were actual security checkpoints. And I had one woman tell me directly to my face, you know, you don't look Jewish. And I look at her and I go, you do? And she just tells me to go and pass through because she could tell how offended I was. Just the audacity to say that to someone when, you know, there's no such thing as what a Jew looks like or a Jew doesn't look like.
You know, I think this is something new that just all of a sudden has occurred in Israel in this last period of time when you went there or when Mike Twitty went there. It was at least, I want to say, 21, 22 years ago when one of my daughters was in Israel and she was called the N-word on a beach, any lot, and actually hit the guy in the head with a Coke bottle, as I remember, in response. I always am proud of her for that. But she,
right. This is like 22 years ago, so that was glass.
Right. That was glass. It wasn't a plastic bottle. No. So
today it would bounce.
But, you know, because that and she felt that a couple of times when she was there. And when she left Israel, she was stopped. They took away things from her that she was taking back to give to my parents. And strip search before she could get out of the airport. So what I'm saying, I guess, this is not this is not something that just happened overnight. This is not something that just has occurred. This is something ongoing that I think that people who are Jewish and people who are Israeli are afraid to address, don't want to address, want to sweep it like it doesn't exist at all.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, you go ahead, Wallace.
I was going to say there's a failure to recognize it exists because no one wants to. For instance, when attention started to be given to the Yiddish word shvatza and how offensive it is,
which means black in Yiddish.
Which technically means black, but you're right, it's the shin word. It's like, it's, you know, the equivalent of the N word in a lot of circles. And when attention started to be given to that, the number one defense was, well, it only means black. It's not a racist term. It's not meant as a racist term, but we all know how it feels. It's that idea of, well, I didn't mean it the way that you're taking it, that self-absolution, that idea of, you know, that defense mechanism, it a lot of times stops that conversation from happening.
And you were going to say, my name is Shana, what?
Oh, it just flew out of my head. But not only the no one wants to talk about it, but when it does happen, it's like, whoa, what do you expect? Or, you know, these are for security reasons. I remember one of the comments on the article from Michael Twitty. It said, you look a certain way, and so you need to, like, accept that certain things are going to happen to you. So you should probably stay out of, like, areas of the world where you're not going to be accepted.
To which I was thinking, so you're telling someone Jewish to stay out of Israel because he doesn't,
right,
quote, look Jewish? Is that the solution that you really just gave?
And whatever we mean by looking Jewish, Mike Twitty has made it through the ice storm to get here to the studio.
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem.
So, Mike Twitty, I talked about what happened. Well, why don't you talk about this experience?
I've been listening and hearing good things from my black up here, my brothers. I'm so glad to have them both. There's this thing, Mark, that says don't read the comments. Well, I had to read the comments this time around. Because I felt there was a lot of protexia around this idea of we have to profile you. Michael, you don't understand. We have to profile you. We have to treat you with suspicion. And,
right.
And we have to, for the safety of us all. And the only thing I could think was, gee, that would have worked really nice with Bernie Madoff. you know, I'm sorry. I don't take this lightly. I have had so many people try to tell me, you know what, leave this alone. Don't fight this battle. Don't bring it up.
This particular thing that occurred to you at the
airport.
Yes.
Don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Take one for the team. And I'm like, hell no. I went to Israel with AIPAC. You hear me? The first time I went to Israel was with AIPAC. I didn't go with YouMightBeJewish.com. I went with the country's leading Israel lobby. I am no longer associated with AIPAC in any way, shape, or form. But that's who brought me there the first time in 2003. And that's what I said to the Israel the folks of the security of Ben Gurion. And I had,
which is the airport.
I had everything to prove it. I was in this festival. I was in Jerusalem Post and Haaretz. And yet I have people still to this day telling me, you know, nothing happened to you that was uncommon. Just deal with it. It's not a thing. And I'm like, no, it is a thing. Because had the situation not been squashed in the 20 minutes it took me to go two levels, I could have easily been one of those people who were dragged into a back room for 6 hours. And that's a thing I want people to understand. I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form the way I was treated equals the way that many people who are Muslim, Arab, or Palestinian are treated at the airport. And I have to say this right now before I forget. There have been many Jewish voices that have said, you know, that's a shanda, it's a shame, it's not good, this is not right. And then there have been a lot of Jewish voices, specifically Israeli voices, that have said to me, you know what, get over it. At least we know you're Jewish because you like to complain. And I'm like, no, it's deeper than that. Because every single Arab and Palestinian person who has reached out to me, not one has said, we compare our experience to yours. They have all said, hey, we've dealt with similar stuff, but we're sorry that your people don't accept you. And that's deep. Not one of them said, my pain's greater than your pain. All of them said, you know, it really sucks that your people don't accept you.
Wow.
And I think that's something I want to get to the phones here. Morning Sunday, and Marie, we're going to get to both of your calls coming up. But I think that's another point here in this country where you don't. I was thinking about the divide that does exist among people in this country who are people of color who are Jewish, especially black folks who are Jewish in this country. And I'm thinking about the synagogue in Chicago. And mm-hmm. I heard their rabbi, a black synagogue in Chicago. And there's a whole organization, what's it called? Bechol Lashon?
Bechol Lashon.
Bechol Lashon.
Which is an organization of Jews of color. And I have some of my issues with that organization for different reasons. But it's an attempt to show the diversity that exists both through conversion into marriage and just people being born Jewish who are of color. All three.
Right.
But there is... One of the things that I always said is that the Jewish community has not wanted to deal with was the racism inside the Jewish community.
That's right.
That exists.
Definitely not. Mm-hmm.
That we always want to kind of go back to looking at Rabbi Heschel walking with Martin Luther King and want to use that as a reason why we don't have to deal with things.
Yeah, so, you know, well, here's the deal. Look, you got these two brothers on the line, right? And you got me here. And we all have these very, very different but very similar stories about the Jewish identity. When this is something that gets me. I never forget, Manish and I will appreciate this story. When I used to go to Crown Heights for Shabbaton, and I would
which
seek
is
after
a white Orthodox Jewish neighborhood.
Yes, and it was very Chabad Lubavitch, definitely not the heart of Afro kosher soul, right? And I remember going there and looking for the family of Rabbi Yisrael Francis, and his family has been Jewish for quite some time. They have a family tree, a Jewish family tree, going back longer than any Hasid I know. And yet the attitude there was still, oh, they're Gerim, they're converts. And I'm like, no, baby, he knows where he comes from. Do you know where you come from? You know, and there's this feeling. You know me in terms of my living history stuff, where I interpret and impersonate slaves. And being in the airport was the first time I felt like I had to have my freedom papers. And I literally pulled up my conversion certificate and said, no. And in my head, in my soul, I felt like, you know, back in the day when our ancestors were on the road and they had to present their papers or else, you know, get hurt, killed, or sold. And you know, that kind of panic. And, you know, I'm sorry, but when I went to Israel the first time, these gentlemen will probably concur with me. I remember we had no one told us about this questioning thing, and that was going on El Al. This was the U.S. Airways returning, but that's a totally separate issue. But El Al gets you from the get-go, and no one told us what's going to happen. Let me tell you something, Mark. I knew the answer to every question. What Torah portion came last? My beard was as long as almost to my waist. I had a black hat in my bag. I had payas, for God's sakes. And I knew every answer, and it came to the point where one security guard asked the other security guard in Hebrew, I can't ask him any more questions. He knows everything. How does he know? And then finally he said, how come you're Jewish? And at this point it was no longer interrogation. It was more like, what the hell happened here? Because the people who came with me on my trip were also, you know, first-timers in Israel. They didn't know anything. These are kids who went the USY and NCSY and Batty, and they went through the Jewish camp and were born Jewish and were white and Ashkenazi and had that privilege, but they didn't know half what I knew about Judaism. And at some point you have to ask yourself, what is our identity about? Who is our people? Who is Am Yisrael? And where does this end? I mean, for me, this is about, it's a discussion about family. This is a family argument. You know, you told me, my daughter had similar experiences. I have a friend of mine who's Asian American, who is Japanese American, and his mother is Ashkenazi, but he looks Japanese American. His name is Japanese, and when he went on Birthright first time, he did some stuff with AIPAC. Then he went back to Israel on his own, and his experiences were basically he got put in a room for 6 hours and interrogated. So I asked the question, are you making allies or are you making enemies when you do this?
So,
do you care?
Right. And Myla, please, I want you to tell them what Mike was saying before we open the phones here.
Oh, I mean, exactly. I can't really disagree. I wanted to, say, you said the first time you went to Israel was in, 2003. My first time going to Israel was in 2000. And I don't remember being, I guess explicitly racially profiled. Like when I went to Israel last time in 2010, pretty much every black person on the flight was pulled to the side for extra security. Mm-hmm. When I went in 2000, it was more... The people, it seemed like then, this was also before 9/11, but they were looking for far more subtle clues than race.
Right.
They were looking for behavioral profiling. How are you acting? Who packed your bags? Like, are your eyes darting around the airport? Do you look like you're nervous? Things like that. And everyone was subject to the same screening, the same level of screening, and they weren't looking for things like conversion papers. They were more looking to, actually look for terrorists. Rather than, racially profiling and just a bit incredulous that somebody non-white is Jewish.
Right. I didn't feel that last time either. I agree with that. I didn't feel that last time either. I just felt like, okay, you're this kid on this trip to Israel, and that's that. And I didn't, and I even noted that when I was in Israel, how people went out of their way to make me feel like, both Arab and Jewish, made me feel like, yo, you're cool, you're okay.
Right.
You're kind of the neutral one. We don't mind you, you're neutral.
You're one of the good ones.
You're Parv.
Right.
While I've
been on court, I can't really speak to the Israel experience because I have yet to have gone. My wife went. But I can very much speak to the level of privilege where you look a certain way, so you don't need to know as much. Right? When I deal with various like white Jews of like differing observance, or you want to say lesser observance or whatever, it's like, you do this, you have these traditions, you have these dishes, you pray here, you pray there, you do this, you do that. And I find it's not really them interested at all in what my level of observance is. It's all a cipher for, well, you know, you have to do all that because you look, you know, this way. I don't mm-hmm. have to do any of that.
Mm-hmm. Let me open the phones here and get some thoughts in. How much time do we have to break? We have time for one caller, and then we will go to break and get the other callers in. 410-319-8888. Morning Sunday, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I have not had the Israeli experience. My brother has. He was denied entry and had to take next time the family history with him to get into Israel. I've had the Baltimore experience. I married a white Jew, and that's in quotations. And between the family and the synagogue and the Jewish community, I was treated like a pariah. I was standing in the synagogue one day waiting for my husband to park the car, and Jews came in and gave me their coats.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to enter what was essentially an all-Jewish building, and I was directed to the back door. When I got pregnant, it became a race to see if his brother's sister might give birth before me so that the oldest child would not be a black Jew. It was a nightmare. The marriage ended because I became nervous and I couldn't handle it anymore. Even going to the Jewish Community Center where they asked me to prove that I was a Jew. You don't have to go overseas to have negative experiences as a black Jew. There's
plenty
right. here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Morning. Good to glad you joined us with those thoughts.
That happened to me. First time I went to a synagogue as an adult, I was asked, the lady said, oh, this young man will be here to take my coat.
So when you first walked in.
First time. That was my first time as an adult in D.C. Yep, going to shul. Mm-hmm.
Did you take the coat?
Oh, I took the coat and I hit it good.
Oh, no, I took the coat and then just let it go right there.
We got to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back and get to our other callers who have called in with our three guests. I'm speaking with author, blogger, and public speaker Manish Tana, hip-hop artist, Orthodox Jew, and Baltimore native Yitz Jordan, a.k.a. Y-Love, and Michael Twitty, culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and blogger at Afro-Culinaria. You listen to all that right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way to break, it's Surf City by Jan and Dean. Jan Berry of Jan and Dean, born on this day in 1941. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's The Wait by The Band, Richard Manuel The Band, born on this day in 1943. In this hour, we're delving into the world of black Jewish traditions and what it means to be both black and Jewish in America and the world. I'm speaking with author, blogger, and public speaker Manish Tana, hip-hop artist, Orthodox Jew, and Baltimore native Yitz Jordan, a.k.a. Y-Love, and Michael Twitty, culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and a blogger at Afro Culinaria. Let's get a couple of callers here right away, and let us go on line two. It's Maria. Maria, you're on the air.
Good morning, good morning, everybody. Look.
Good morning.
Good morning. A few years ago in the United States, they had on the evening news or whatever a story about first Jews. I think they were, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ethiopians. But they said on this television show, a news station, that the first Jews were dark-skinned. Can you all comment on that? And I'll hang up.
Thank you, Maria. And that's an interesting question. Everybody thinks that we all know what the first was. Nobody really kind of...
So, well, yeah, let me break this down, because I know my fellow folks have something to say, so I'll do this quickly. I think if you co-sign on to the idea that we're all on Israel, then we have a pact with each other to put phenotypes separate and secondary or tertiary or way in the background to the feeling of being a Jew. That's what connects me to Mark. If I didn't know that Mark had African-American Jewish children, he would still be a Jew to me. And there are times when I've had people who were not, you know, they're not so connected or not so engaged, and I would say things like, well, you know, the Rebbe taught us to, you know, greet every Jew with a smile. And one guy said, that's so tribalistic. And I said, you don't realize what's a smile from one Jew to another means until you're black and Jewish and nobody wants to smile at you. So that's your privilege to say that let's all get along. But to my elder's point, there's without a question, when you go back to the ancient Middle East was originally the crossroads of Africa and Asia. And there is no doubt in my mind, and no doubt in terms of science, that we're talking about people of color being the first Israel. Now, to what extent they look like me or look like Mark or look like something, a place between us, is a matter of speculation. But it is worth repeating and noting that, you know, when I used to teach Hebrew school for most of my living, we used to always do the ethnic lesson, the color lesson, because I was almost always the only figure of authority of color that was male these kids ever met or knew. And so I asked them, how did I get to be my color? And the kids would go, well, a long time ago, these are sixth graders, a long time ago, your ancestors were in Africa and the sun was really hot. And so you got brown. And I said, okay, that's sort of pseudoscientific, but okay, we'll work with that. But I said, why do I have a straight hair in my beard? And why do I have straight hair on my arms? And why do I look lighter? Why do I look different from, say, someone from Africa, from West Africa, that you may know? And so I asked the kids, how did you get red hair? How does she look different from you? And they never had to think about the fact that a group of Middle Eastern Jews went to Europe after the Roman exile expulsion and got heavily mixed with everybody else and became essentially white Jews. And they never have to think about that question of miscegenation. I mean, Mark, look at Barbara Walters a couple years ago when Henry Louis Gates gave her the deal. And she was like, I thought I was all Jewish. And it turned out she had plenty of Cossacks in her woodpile. You know, so we're not the only ones to have this discussion about color. But to us, color is secondary, tertiary to the feeling and the being part of the family of Israel.
Well, I love you. Want to jump in on that? Then we'll go to the phones.
And also, I was going to say, you know, that to the extent that conversion plays a, you know, a factor in the equation for Jews of color, it plays a different factor in the equation for white Jews. I've seen white Jews who are converts convert and then all of a sudden be, you know, accepted more than a black convert would be. And I've heard of, you know, white converts being told things like, oh, I could tell you were going to convert anyway. You have such a Jewish face. And it's like, really? This is some, like, he looks like, you know, a character on Leave It to Beaver. But what? you know.
Or you have such a Jewish soul. I love that one.
You know, there's that level of, you know, privilege that even exists through the conversion process that we're not privy to.
So we have a lot of calls. Let me try to get some of them in the part of this conversation. 410-319-8888. And Octavia.
I would just, oh,
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, I love, who's that? Money?
Who's Money? I also want to jump in on that question. I'd also like to point out that it's, one, very important, and two, unimportant. Like, in the larger scheme of things, as Michael was saying before, it's something that's, you know, secondary and tertiary to Judaism. But, you know, we live in the society that we do today, and so nothing is in its pure ideal form.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to go anthropologically, yes, realistically, the Fertile Crescent was a much darker place than it is today. But when most people ask or say, you know, the first Jews were dark, they're thinking black as in how black is defined nowadays in terms of race, as mm-hmm. African descended, et cetera, which they weren't necessarily African, but you can have someone from India, someone from Korea, someone from the Caribbean, someone from America, who are all the exact same shade, but only one of them is classified as black.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about the shade color level, yes, very much. Another point that also needs to be brought up simultaneously when you are bringing that point, because then you have rise to the whole, you know, Kazar theory where, you know, white Jews, nationalist Jews aren't really Jews, or like, you know, European converts, and if they were real, they'd look like this. That's not necessarily true. If, you know, well, you have black daughters, and if they keep, you know, marrying other black people, you'll have black descendants. You have a different daughter who marries Asians, and she can marry Asians. You'll have Asian descendants, and someone else who marries, like, Indians. So in, like, right. 300 years, you'll have three different ethnic groups that are all equally authentically, you know, connected and part of one family and part of the original, whatever you want to say.
Right.
So I think right. that's something that other people also take into account. Jews look like the places where they're from.
Right.
Why? Because they mix into the places they were from. That doesn't mean they don't all come from the same root of people in the first place.
Important points.
Exactly.
Really important. Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Go to Octavia. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Octavia.
How are you?
Very well.
Great. I just wanted to say, basically, being a black Jew for me, and I sort of converted to Judaism before I married my husband, who I met in high school. And it's sort of a mixed experience. I've been, you know, I lived in the UK. I've been to Israel on a birthright trip. I've been in Baltimore for the last 8 years. And so we're sort of part of a shul and a school community of people who know who we are and accept us, so we're sort of safe. But at the same time, I've had, you know, people in the school, because the only other black people who are in my children's school, you know, they work there.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I just go to pick up my children and someone will say, oh, can I help you? You look lost. And I'm like, no, I don't look lost. I'm actually just coming to pick up my children. But I've had situations where, you know, people come up to me all the time because I do keep strictly kosher. I only eat at kosher restaurants and things like that. And so sometimes I'm, you know, if I'm in a store or something like that, someone will just ask me my story as if they have a right to know anything mm-hmm. about me, and you just met me 2 seconds ago.
I love that.
Another experience I had in Baltimore was at a local kosher restaurant. The mashgiach, the person who makes sure that all the food is kosher, when I was in the restaurant with my mom, came over to me and basically told us, you know, did we know that we were in a kosher restaurant and that there were sort of certain expectations. And the owner, who knew me because I had gone there a number of times, was really mortified and came over and apologized, and then had the mashgiach come out and apologize to me. And what he said was that he didn't know I was Jewish.
When he started
talking to me, and I was so offended because I said, so I deserve to be treated differently because you don't know that I'm Jewish. But at the same time, I am part of a shul community and a school community who love us and accept us. So I've sort of, you know, had this mixed bag. But, like, I think it was one of your guests who said, you know, going to a shul, like going to a shul in the U.K., I lived in London for a while during grad school, and every time I would go to shul, I would basically be stopped and questioned at the door. And so I'm totally used to that. I'm okay with that. But I think the most hurtful thing for me that's ever happened is when I was on Birthright Israel, it was in 1999, I think. It was sort of the second intifada, and we went. And what happened when we went to the Dead Sea was that a number of the students from universities in New York decided to take their mud and create black faces for themselves, and they put on a minstrel show on the beach at the dead. And I found myself, that was actually, I'm from Louisiana, and I have never felt that I've been victimized because of who I am, because of my race. And that was the first time I was so hurt, and I sat on that beach and cried, and I will never forget that. And so as much as I love, you know, being Jewish, and I almost wish I could, sometimes being a black Jew is like being a part of a family who doesn't want you. It's just, but I mean, as much as, you know, I also have experiences where, you know, when I had a baby, my shul members organized food, and, right. you know, for a month we didn't have to cook. So I'm not saying it's all bad, but to say that it, there aren't problems within our community is just crazy, and it's dishonest.
Octavia, I'm really glad you got through, and I know you originally we called you earlier. Hopefully, you could be a guest on today's show, but I'm glad you called in. I appreciate you being part of this conversation. Before we go back to the phones here, there's a ton of people calling in here. I want to try to get to them. Michael Twitty, what were you about to
say? Yeah, that was an extraordinary testimony to how I think we all feel. There are parts of being Jewish without which it's a very different sort of family and safety net than being African-American. Because you don't have to, average African-American walking down the street, we give each other a nod, but we don't have to do nothing for you. But, you know, when you do have other Jews, that doesn't matter if they belong to a shul or if they're just by acting on their own, there's a compulsory obligation to treat each other with, you know, respect and love. And 80% of the time, that's what I feel. And that's something that I can't get anywhere else. But what I will say to Ms. Octavia's experience is this. I do have a problem being profiled as a black male who's a teacher, who's worked with different Jewish groups, going into shuls, going to synagogues. I certainly do respect her her acceptance of that to a certain degree. But for me, that's a deep problem because our community should know us. They should know that we exist. My heart went out to her with her stories because, you know, having been told, you know, you are or not this. When I was on I spoke to a guy one time, out of the blue on the bus. He said, "Oh, you're Jewish." I'm Jewish too. And I said, he said, "How long have you been Jewish?" And I said, "Well, sir, I converted." And he said to me, "You will know when you're really Jewish," and I thought I was going to hear something really racist, and it wasn't. He said, "You know when you're really Jewish, when the Jews are your family, whether you like them or not." And it took years for that to sink in. Sometimes they're your best friends, and sometimes you don't know what to do with them, and they make drive you crazy. And he said, "That's when you know you're going to be really Jewish," and he was right.
I wanted to accent something that Ms. Octavia said before, that talking about how she had a wonderful, supportive synagogue community. Once the N-word was said in my presence, well, not in my presence, I wasn't really listening, but once the N-word was said in my presence in yeshiva, and someone told the head of the yeshiva about it when I was learning in Jerusalem and Israel, the rabbi got so furious and said, "Do you see," and points to one of the guys who was of Moroccan descent, and said, "Do you see everybody in the Talmud look like this? People in scripture look like this. The only reason you have blonde hair and blue eyes is because some Cossack raped your great-grandmother.
Tell it.
This young man is a baby and an idiot. He is the reason the Messiah is not here." Like, he went on and on about, like, this racist incident, and, you know, we never had a problem again that year. Once a synagogue establishes that there won't be any racism in that place, once a synagogue community is welcoming, that really enhances the lives
works
of
wonders.
Black Jews in that area.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it counts as almost anything. It doesn't even need the rabbi to do that, because I had a similar experience in my synagogue where, you know, it was like Simchat Torah, so this guy was drinking, he was drunk, and the porters of the synagogue, you know, were actually Caribbean American. So he's throwing peanuts around, and his friends around him like, hey, you know, cut that out. He's like, "No, don't worry, you know, the niggers can clean it up." And so I was sitting like two rows away, and I was like, "Oh, this is going to be fun." So I went back to him the next day, you know, when he's not drunk, you know, when he would show up with his friends. Like, come over to him. It's like, "Hey, what's going on?" And he's like kind of embarrassed because he knows why I'm there. He's like, "Oh, I was just really drunk yesterday. No, I didn't. It's like, "Well, just wanted to know whether or not we were going to hear anything ridiculously stupid or female today." Is that going to happen? No. I go and sit down. Services happen. I come back at the end. I'm like, congratulations. You made it through the entire service. And nothing absolutely asinine came out of your mouth.
Mazel tov.
Yeah. So then, you know, one of his friends, who was like a sort of mutual friend, came up and said, oh, you know, I want to apologize, you know, because, you know, we're all Jews. And I was like, no, Paul. Sure, we're all Jews, you and I. But me and the porters, we're also all black.
Mm.
So this isn't a one side against the other thing. You're saying that something that applies to that group, I'm also part of that group, that applies to that group. So I found out like 2 or 3 years later, we went back there, we were hanging out, and it became sort of the in-joke in the synagogue in a sort of good-natured, scolding kind of way. And someone there started telling the story, and I was there. I was like, that was me in the story. He's like, that was you? It was your family? Oh, when he said it, they told me about it. I, like, smacked him in the face. And, like, so, like, the synagogues themselves, like, scolded the situation without me even knowing it even happened until years after the fact.
Mm.
So it's not even not just the rabbi sometimes, even though that's very important to have that authority taken behind it. It has to be part of the ideology of the people that also go there. Right.
Right.
I've seen racists ejected from synagogues, you know, before for that exact reason. If the community is not having it, they're simply not having it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me return to the phones here and get some of our listeners here, a couple of them in a row maybe, to get some thoughts and then come back to our guests at 410-319-8888. Matt, on line 3, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Matt, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, how y'all doing?
Very well.
Hey.
I mean, I just wanted to, you know, throw a comment out and say that, you know, to me, some of this is kind of a joke in the sense that, you know, nobody really wants to deal with the historical fact. You know, even at the outset of the show, you know, you said you were going to have a black Jew on. You know, it's kind of like, you know, amongst the Ashkenazi or the Jewish community, you know, that are European, they, you know, for those who are of African descent, need to realize that, you know, the mass majority of them are never going to accept you. And that, you know, we don't need to. Those of us who are, you know, acknowledge our, you know, Israelite heritage, and we know who we descend from, many of us in the diaspora, we need to understand that we don't need to convert. You know, it's a shame that when the Israelis came and brought the so-called falasha from Ethiopia to Israel, they're going to make the people convert. You know, so it's a subtle racism going on, and I feel like we don't need to accept their form of so-called Judaism. Moses gave the Torah. You know, all of these regulations and Talmudic principles that is wrapped up in so-called Judaism is not historically accurate. You know, the Torah is what is accurate. And we don't need to convert to become a Jew. You know, we were born that. Even if we are calling ourselves African-American of the diaspora and of the Caribbean and don't know who we are, if you study historical facts, you will understand that's who we are. The so-called lost tribes, it's a reason why we call ourselves African-American and have no remembrance of our heritage. We don't even read the scriptures, and this is all biblical prophecy that speaks of all of these things. So I just want to, you know, finish up my comment and say that we don't need to convert to Judaism. You know what I'm saying? We were already born that, you know, we don't need to convert to their form of Judaism, and that is not what makes us a Jew. Peace.
So here's my immediate reaction to my brother's comment. I've always told members of the quote-unquote mainstream Jewish community that black Hebrew or Hebrew Israelite is my brother, my cousin, part of my mishpacha. Where I disagree is that what I signed on for was Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism doesn't pretend that it is solely based on Torah. It's based on the oral tradition that followed when Jews became part of the diaspora. What my brother is speaking to is this idea that we need other people's validation or acceptance to be who we are. I think that's the most important point. I don't think that white Jews are inauthentic. I don't think that yellow Jews or brown Jews or red Jews or whatever are inauthentic. I think they're inauthentic when they prove by their actions and by their words that they really don't have a Jewish heart, that they really don't have a pentelia, they don't have a Jewish soul. Unfortunately, our people do that all the time, and that is a great avera, it's a great sin. But I think that it's very important that we make the comment that the three of us follow or are part of a rabbinic tradition in some form or another. And I don't know if I don't know at what point do I call other people, you know, valid or invalid based on what they look like or who they are. But I would agree with my brother's point that ultimately it comes down to a matter of we don't need people to validate or accept us. We can validate and accept ourselves. That's that.
Exactly. That's an important point. And I have some questions, but I'll try to get in. But let me again go back to the phones. There's so many people calling in at 410-319-8888. Mary on line two, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Marion calling from
Randall. Oh, Marion. Hi, Marion.
The reason I was calling and the previous caller brought it up, I do recall a number of years ago the State of Israel sent planes over to Ethiopia to rescue people that they discovered were Jewish, and they had been living Jewish lives there for centuries and were being subjected to very harsh sorts of torturous events from the African tribes surrounding them. Israel sent a plane, brought the people over, gave them everything they needed. My understanding was set them up in Israeli society. And I was trying to figure out, would your guests know how these people are doing now? It has to have been at least 20 years if they have any information as to how those people are doing. Are they part of Israel culture and community, society, politics? And I'll just take my answer off of the air. Thank you.
Mary, thanks. That's a great question. And let me kind of slide it into another question that ties into this. I have an emailer, a mediocrity, who wrote in, why are they profiling blacks? What have blacks done to warrant this kind of scrutiny? Mm. Was there a bombing or is it just old-fashioned racism? And I throw that into this mix of what Mary was saying, as well as Leah Tarachansky, who is a reporter and a documentary filmmaker who is an Israeli Jew who grew up in the settlements and has produced several documentaries. One of those documentaries she's working on right now is about the expulsion of Sudanese and Eritreans who are asylum workers who are Africans, black people living in Israel, doing a lot of the work, and are treated in really a kind of very deeply racist ways in that country. And then that tying that into the whole question of where the Ethiopian Jews are, because it's a mixed bag, really, where Ethiopian Jews are. Many who feel the racism, but they also make up increasing numbers of Ethiopian Jews are in the police forces.
Right.
You know, as well. So it's a really... It is a very complex question, but racism is at the heart of a lot of it, I think.
Well, of course. I mean, these gentlemen will certainly back this up. I mean, I remember 10 years ago, Ethiopian Jews went to clubs, right? You know who they had on the wall? Malcolm, Martin, and Marcus. That's who they identified with. They identified with us. It was a spectacular thing when I first went to Israel. And, you know, you see Ethiopian Jewish kids, and they run up to you with great deal of respect and great deal of love, like, hey, our brother, Achi, you know, and they knew you were from America, and they took pictures with you, and they give you the shirt off their back, because they were still, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's not envision the Ethiopian community in Israel as some, you know, like underclass, this, like, you know, these horrible poor people who just came off of a plane. Like, you know, these are they're in parliament, they're beauty queens, they're beauty pageant winners, they're entrepreneurs, they're engineers, they're professionals, lawyers, everything.
Right.
It's not just the, you know, the cleaning people.
This has been a, you know, 30, 40 year now process of slow integration. There are still issues there. But, I mean, when it comes to the asylum work, one of the things that worried me on this present trip was I didn't want to be called an infiltrator. I don't know what the word is in Hebrew, but the word infiltrator translated is kind of like people say wet back here, unfortunately. And it's being used against these Northeast African asylums. And it's horrific to see some of the videos film on YouTube of people coming, saying, cushy, cushy, get out of my country. I was born here. These people are not, like, fighting back. They're scared. They're upset. There are black people freezing in the security prison in Holot right now as we speak. And they just want to go. They're tired of it. They just want to go back home. But they won't let them go back into Israel, and they want them to go back home. And they're sitting there without blankets, without heaters, and they're freezing. You know, the question is, well, what is that Jewish? You know, you want to ask me, do I look Jewish? I'm asking you, do you feel Jewish? You know, that is, to me, that is not Judaism, to treat the stranger with disrespect. To me, that is the, that is anti-Torah.
This is this has been a fascinating conversation. We can go on more and more. I'm going to invite you all to come back. Michael Twitty, first of all, I appreciate you coming back all the way up here and driving up on this slippery, sloppy day. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, sir.
Linking to Afro-Culinaria and all the work Michael Twitty has done on this program. And Wylov, great to have you back again.
Thank you.
Be linking to your website so people can hear your music and know where you're coming from. And Manash Shana as well, to your website, because you're doing some incredible, deep-thinking writing that I want people to see. And look forward to having you back.
Thank you,
as well.
Brothers.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the calls coming in. We try, but we have... I guess when you marry black and Jewish worlds, there's a lot of talking going on. So this is all right. Good to thank you. Thank you, three brothers, for being in the studio today, being on the show today. Appreciate it.
Oh, man.
Thank you so much.
And on our way to break, oh, not break, we're actually here. Our closing music today is the great Ruth Brown again performing Lucky Lips, born on this day in 1928, the great Ruth Brown. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Day in History Research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for your source for cool jazz and more, Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Rabbit foot, good luck charm.